It's on the hillside opposite the ancient stone walls of Jerusalem, commanding a sweeping view of the valley below. It's the small olive grove where Christ prayed to be delivered from the terrible destiny that was soon to befall him. But Christ, who humbly accepted his fate, was to endure his torment in solitude. His three disciples had fallen asleep nearby. Well, since the 4th century, the faithful have included the Garden of Olives, or Gethsemane, in their pilgrimages to the places of the Lord's Passion. Today, pilgrims can stroll through the small grove and pray or stop to reflect on Christ's last hours among the gnarled, wizened olive trees shading the garden paths. In the early 20th century, the Franciscans, with the financial help of many nations, built a new basilica over the ruins of a 4th-century church and the rubble of a Byzantine shrine. The faithful can also visit the Grotto of the Betrayal, the place where for centuries local Christians have believed Christ was betrayed by Judas. As part of our series of Lenten reflections on Christian sites in the Holy Land, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us up the hill to the Garden of Gethsemane, recalling the agony of that night.
The site is a most impressive, appealing one, even today. One finds in the garden surrounding the Church of All Nations massive olive trees, and botanists are able to say, yeah, as a matter of fact, one or two of those are 2,000 years old.
So they would have been there.
They would have been witnesses, living witnesses to the Lord's agony in the garden. And if one goes from the cenacle down to the Garden of Olives, St. John tells us in his gospel that Jesus went through the Kidron Valley and he passed over the Kidron Stream. And we're thinking, why mention that little piece of geography? Who cares? I had to cross a stream. Well, as a matter of fact, as the sacrifices were being immolated at the temple in preparation for the Passover, that stream, there was a channel or a canal, if you will, from the site of the sacrifices of the lambs. So the blood went down into that stream.
So this is during Passover.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when John tells us that Jesus passed over the Kidron Stream, one can see that he can look into that stream and see the blood of the lambs.
And that's another passing over.
Exactly. Another passing over. He passes over that. And as a matter of fact, all of the blood that's going down in that stream that night is going to be fulfilled in his shedding of his blood the next day. So it's a marvelous piece of information. John is not only just a great theologian, but he's an incredibly sensitive and subtle writer, and you get these little tidbits, which seem like, oh, cute, clever, interesting piece of information. But as a matter of fact, if you look a little deeper, you find that there's a profound theological truth that he's trying to convey there. At any rate, once again, that inner circle, Peter, James, and John, that are with Jesus on the Mount of the Transfiguration, that are with him for the raising of the daughter of Jairus, are now with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what do? They sleep. And St. Thomas More has a wonderful book called The Sadness of Christ, which he wrote while he was in the Tower of London. And it's an extended meditation on the agony in the garden. And he makes a somewhat cynical but telling comment. He says, in England at this moment, there are people claiming that the bishops are not the successors of the apostles. And he said, and that is completely false, and it's proven by this agony in the garden. He says, Peter, James, and John, among the first bishops in the church, as a matter of fact, slept through our Lord's most pitiful moment. He said, just as the bishops in England today are sleeping while the persecution of the church is going on. Of course, he's referring to the fact that only one bishop in England refused to sign the oath of supremacy, St. John Fisher, who was martyred as a result, and the papal nuncio. All the other bishops collaborated. And the message isn't simply about bishops being unfaithful to Christ. It's, as a matter of fact, Christians historically do exactly the same thing. We are asleep at the switch. Instead of identifying with Christ in his passion, we prefer to do other things, whether that's physical sleep or all kinds of distracting activities, so that we get our mind off something as annoying as following a suffering Christ.
Gethsemane was also the site where, of course, Jesus was betrayed by a kiss.
That's right. And that shows the depth of the malevolence, to use a symbol of friendship to betray. Many spiritual writers throughout the centuries have made the observation that what made our Lord sweat the drops of blood, which of course there is good medical evidence that that can indeed happen, was not the prospect of the physical suffering, but that he was able, in his intense humanity and at the same time joined to his divine person, able to see the betrayal of Judas, the denial of Peter, but also the disunity in his church throughout history. And this is what weighed on his sacred heart and on his mind more than anything else. And this is what caused this intense suffering and the agony in the garden. So that, as a matter of fact, and seeing the sins of the world until the end of time, not so much the crucifixion, that would have been over within a few hours, but that the agony of Christ continues, we can say, through the sins that are committed day in and day out by you and by me.
They seized Jesus and led him away and took him to the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. A servant girl recognized him and said, "This man was with him." But Peter denied it. A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, yet another person exclaimed, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." And again Peter replied, "I do not know what you are talking about." Just as he uttered those words, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. And Peter remembered what the Lord had said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times." And he went outside and wept bitterly.
Peter's betrayal of Christ is an important part of the Lord's Passion and was remembered by the earliest Christians in Jerusalem. Today, the Church of St. Peter of Gallicantu, Latin for "the place where the cock crowed," stands on the slopes of Jerusalem's Mount Zion, on the site where Jesus was believed to have been imprisoned by the high priest Caiaphas. Though the actual church dates from 1931, built by the Assumptionist Fathers, it was constructed over the ruins of a 5th century shrine and rises above a series of crypts and chambers carved out of rock in the very first few decades after Christ's crucifixion.
In Gallicantu means at cock's crow. And we recall that our Lord predicted that Peter would deny him three times before the cock crows. And this church, as a matter of fact, commemorates that event. If you look at the Porta Santa in St. Peter's Basilica, the door used for access during Jubilee years, during Holy Years, there is one frame that is the conversion of Peter, it's called, the Conversio Petri, the turning of Peter. And St. Luke does this in a very touching manner. He says that at Peter's betrayal, he turned and he saw the face of Christ and wept. And it's the converting look. It's Peter turning, seeing Jesus, and in that instant realizing the terrible horror of what he had done. If we want to contrast the persons of Judas and Peter, both of them committed horrendous sins, but the difference, and both of them were intensely sorry. Judas's sorrow ends in an act of despair because it's not turned toward Christ. It's turned toward the self. I'm sorry for what I did, but I don't go to the right source to deal with the problem. So his ends in the despairing act of suicide. Peter's sorrow turns outward toward the only one who can help us really deal with guilt, and that's Christ. And, as a matter of fact, it's transformative. His sorrow is brought to a completion in a renewed relationship with Christ, which we find depicted at the site of Tabgha, where Jesus appears to Peter after the resurrection and commissions him to be the substitute shepherd, we can say, for the church. Now, people today at times have some unrealistic expectations of ecclesiastical leaders. While they themselves feel quite comfortable sinning on a regular basis and having access to the sacrament of penance whenever they want it, which is good, they somehow think that simply by virtue of sacramental ordination or episcopal consecration that a man loses his humanity or somehow he becomes subsumed into Christ's divinity. And they're uncomfortable with sinners leading the church. But what's fascinating about this is that, as a matter of fact, in that Easter commissioning of Peter to be the substitute shepherd, Jesus asks Peter, "Simon, Peter, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Simon, Peter, do you love me more than these?" "Yeah, but..." And then even dumb Peter gets it. He was asking this three times. Could that be a reason? "Oh, I denied him three times." So yes, the triple denial is undone by a triple profession of love. But then there's something that's very interesting that follows. Precisely within the context of reminding Peter, painfully, one must imagine, of his horrific sin, Jesus then commissions him to be the rock of the church. "Feed my lambs, feed my sheep." Jesus is not uncomfortable in having imperfect ministers run his church. Now, that's not to say, fine, then go sin all you want as a priest or a bishop or anything else. But it is important to appreciate the fact that one's personal sinfulness does not impede one from, as a matter of fact, doing the pastoral work of the church. Admittedly, the goal must always be that there's a complete as possible, as humanly possible, consonance between one's personal life and one's public vocation. But at the same time, it's just good to put this in a little bit of perspective. And again, to go back to this healing look of Jesus that's able to convert all of us, and all of us, as a matter of fact, are in need of daily reconversion. Conversion is not a one-shot deal. This is one of the mistakes made so often by fundamentalists, that I gave my life over to Jesus 20 years ago, I said the sinner's prayer, and everything is hunky-dory since then. It's not. It's Jesus tells us in Luke's gospel that we must carry our cross daily. Luke adds the word daily. And if it's a daily carrying the cross, it's also a daily asking for the grace to be able to carry the cross, and a daily asking for forgiveness when we fail to do that.
And a warm thanks there to Father Peter Stravinskas, a noted scholar and author and editor of the Catholic Response.